What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
One of the great oxymorons in our society, as we look at America Trends, is the Department of Corrections. Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, John Krosick, and neither of us have had much exposure to a Department of Corrections, except for that short stay, that federal commitment that John made about 3 to 4 years in length. No, I'm only kidding, right, John?
Yeah, I was sort of thinking about that, sort of in tune with military intelligence.
Oh, military intelligence, the Department of Corrections. John, too often we hear that we've got too many people imprisoned and too many people who are imprisoned who end up being re-imprisoned or becoming recidivists, as we call them. And the big problem here is that when they are in STIR, oftentimes they're spent stirring and they're not getting the training and the re-education to make them productive citizens on the outside. Do you hear that?
Well, I think also on the outside, I mean, everybody's struggling for jobs. So, and here if you've been arrested and, you know, a felon or whatever, it's going to be make it that much harder to get a job in a market that's already hard.
Well, I know there is this movement to block the box so you don't have to indicate that you spent some time in prison or what have you, but that's really difficult. I mean, if you've got 5 years missing, absent on your resume, and they say, by the way, not for nothing, but where were you during those 5 years, Mr. Krofczyk? No, I mean, what are you going to say?
You're right. Well, I had 1 year missing because I took a year off when my daughter was born, and when I went back to work, they kind of looked at that and they said,
you were a stay-at-home dad.
I was a stay-at-home dad
wow,
for a year.
John, I didn't realize that. Good for you.
Except it didn't help me when I went out job hunting again.
Well, there, and that's 1 year to raise a child. And this is 5 years and for raising ruckus, I guess.
Right, so it's got to be difficult.
Well, it's got to be difficult, let's be honest. And we have so many people who are imprisoned, and many of them really want the opportunity to succeed going forward. And there have been many proposals about a second chance society. In fact, Congress is working on legislation they're calling the First Step Act, and that aims to reduce prisoner recidivism rates. But one of the ways that you can do that, I think, is by improving employment outcomes and making certain that somebody gets attached to work very quickly once they've been released from prison.
I absolutely. Once they, you know, if you're working and you got the money, you know, it's all good.
Well, let's be honest about it. The other point to this is if they don't get attached to work very quickly and new habits and new people, they're going to go back to their old ways. And that is not going to be productive for them or society. Let's be honest about it.
No, you're absolutely right. So I think it is good. The trouble is, where do these jobs come from?
Well, we can talk about that. But we also want to talk about the employment and training aspect to all of this to find out whether, in fact, corrections is more appropriately labeled today than it was in the past, or are we still just spending a lot of time in prison with a lot of people not really productively reinventing their lives?
Hopefully we'll be enlightened in this podcast on this.
Well, there is a study that came out, or a report called The Effectiveness of Education and Employment Programming for Prisoners. Grant Dewey is with us, and he addresses a lot of these questions. And he's got a dual role, John. He's at AEI for Criminal Justice Reform. He's an advisor. And he's also the research director for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. So he's putting it into practice as well as studying it. So here's a man who really has given all these concepts a lot of thought. So how can we improve upon this and make certain that somebody's not going to be a repeat offender? We'll tackle that issue today on America Trends.
Well, there is a new report out called The Effectiveness of Education and Employment Programming for Prisoners. With us, a gentleman very much involved in this particular report. He is the academic advisor to the American Enterprise Institute for Criminal Justice Reform and research director for the Minnesota Department of Corrections, Grant Dewey. And Grant, I think a lot of people wonder, how effective are these various education programs in our prisons? And I would imagine they are effective to a varying degree depending on type and how they're administered and the like.
Yes, that's correct. First off, thank you for having me on your program. And I think what's important to emphasize is that education programming within U.S. prison systems have been around for a long time, because it's been recognized that prisoners have long been undereducated. We see, for example, that about 40% enter prison without a high school degree or GED. And then we see that prisoners are less likely to have a post-secondary degree compared to the general population. But what we do see is that when individuals earn a secondary degree or a post-secondary degree in prison, that it does improve outcomes relating to prison misconduct, post-release employment, recidivism, as well as cost avoidance.
But when we look at it, certain programs that start in the prison and then are not continued when they end up either in a situation in the community, back out on work release, the continuum where somebody really has a program that is really dedicated to getting them a job on the outside, how important is that continuum?
When it comes to employment programming, and employment programming for prisoners can run the gamut from prison labor to programs that tend to be offered strictly in the community after someone gets released from prison, like work release. So there are a variety of employment programs that are available for those who are in prison as well as those who get released from prison. But one of the things that we see for employment programming that tends to be more effective is that there is a continuum of service delivery from the institution to the community. With programs like prison labor, which are delivered exclusively within prison, we do see some beneficial outcomes, but mm-hmm. the impact on recidivism, for example, is very limited, if not non-existent. We see prison labor generates good outcomes for finding a job after someone gets released from prison, but its impact on recidivism is very modest. And we see a little better outcomes for community-based programs like work release, but the best outcomes that are observed are those for employment programs that start when someone's in prison and continue after they get released from prison.
And Grant, that makes a lot of sense. I recall reading an article some years back, and you think about it, a lot of the guys, and primarily guys, though women too, yep, who go to prison, I mean, they're there because they don't have an education, or they don't have really a lot of work-related skills, and they may not have the best time management skills. So unless they're followed and monitored, the likelihood that they're going to go back to some of their old ways and their old relationships, which were not healthy and certainly not work-involved, are much greater.
And the research bears that out to employment programs, by the way. We see a continuum of care or service delivery from prison to the community. That's a common thread that runs through a lot of effective correctional programs. And what kind of exacerbates that situation is that a lot of service delivery models are fragmented within the community, and so it makes it very challenging to provide effective services for individuals after they get released from prison. But when you have a program or an intervention that begins while someone's incarcerated and continues after they get released, that it can foster a more successful transition to the community.
For those of us who have not been involved in this particular field, and that's probably 99.9% of us who are on this podcast today, there are some who might think that prison should be punitive. They want somebody to pay for their crime. Then others who say, well, some form of rehabilitation. Then this issue of corrections and employment and hoping for the best for the individual and spending some money investing in them, to some is the appropriate thing to do, the smart thing to do, and for others, why should we be doing that? I mean, how much do we still have to deal with various ideas about what a prison is?
We absolutely have to deal with it, just because it pervades all of the discussions that we have about how we use prison and what prison should be like. The idea that prison should be a very punitive place in which little or no rehabilitative programming is provided is an idea that is very old and it endures still to this day. The problem with that approach, however, is that it has seldom yielded very good outcomes. And this is something that dates back to the beginning of the penitentiary in the early 19th century, is that we put individuals in prison and we make the experience so miserable that they will never want to return. But the evidence suggests that approach does not work at all. It's also very, very costly and wasteful. One of the more recent ideas is that we still make prison very punitive. We make the experience as miserable as possible for the individual, but we try to provide a little bit of rehabilitative programming in there. And this is what we've really tried to do, I would say, over the last 30 to 40 years. However, given the fact that we have arguably overused prison, it's been very difficult to provide programming to a large number of individuals who are in prison. Instead, what we do is we warehouse a lot of individuals who go to prison. And the research has shown that when we warehouse prisoners, it leads to worse recidivism outcomes. So I think from a long-term perspective, if we provide programming that is shown to be effective in reducing the extent to which individuals go back to prison, then that is something in which we should invest more in. And that's one of the arguments that I've tried to make, not just in the recent AEI paper, but in some of the more recent writings that I've done on prison reform.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. That's right. We're the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
Now, you are the research director for the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and I would imagine that you guys are doing some pretty innovative things in Minnesota as a result of your studies. So tell us, how different is what you've been actually doing in the prisons on the ground in Minnesota than many other places?
Well, I think one of the things that is nice about the Minnesota Department of Corrections is that there has been a willingness to try programming that is somewhat innovative and try to provide individuals with more programming while they are incarcerated. And one of those examples is Minnesota Circles of Support and Accountability, which is a reentry program for high-risk sex offenders. And this is an intervention that started in Canada in the early 1990s and has showed some good results there. But we were able to start a similar program in Minnesota in 2008 in a recent evaluation that we did just showed that it reduces sexual recidivism by 88%. And for every individual who participates in that program, it delivers a benefit to taxpayers of a little more than $40,000 per participant. And so this is an example of a relatively innovative intervention that delivers good outcomes, but at the same time, it is not a punitive intervention, which is the prevailing thought when it comes to someone like sex offenders, that we just need to be more punitive with them and we'll get better outcomes. Whereas here's an intervention that suggests if perhaps we do the opposite, we provide them with social support while also trying to make sure that they stay accountable, that we can still achieve good outcomes that way.
And for somebody who is skeptical, why should we care about the recidivism rate? I mean, you talked about the fact that we overuse prisons in America, and I think those numbers are startling in relation to the rest of the world, but why should people care about people going back and back to prison?
Because crime is costly. That when someone commits a crime, that we have the cost to the victim. We also have costs to society, that when someone commits a serious criminal offense, that there are costs to police, there are costs to the court system, and if the offense is serious enough, then costs to our correctional system as well. So when we're able to reduce the extent to which individuals recidivate, then that means fewer costs to society, but then that means that fewer of our neighbors, fewer of our friends, fewer family members may become victims of crime.
And there is no one that I know, at least in the Northeast where we come from and you in the Midwest, that still calls their prison system a prison system. They do call it corrections. Is that generally what is applied across the board? Because you said there is still a lot of warehousing that goes on. Corrections suggests something well beyond that.
Well, I think that all prison systems would like to believe that they do some correcting, but I think the reality, however, is that we have been locked in a cycle, and this has especially been true since the early 1980s when imprisonment rates, not just for the 50 states, but also for the federal prison system, that imprisonment rates started to increase dramatically. And as prison populations began to grow, it became more difficult to provide programming to those individuals who came into prison. Instead, the most urgent concern for prison administrators is just to find a prison bed, for those entering or reentering the system. Another development that we've seen as the prison population has dramatically increased is an increasing number of individuals who are coming into prison for short periods of time, either as a probation violator or as parole violators. And when we have individuals who are coming into prison for short stints, whether it's 2 months or 3 months or 4 months, they really can't participate in any programming. And that increases the odds that someone will get warehoused. And usually what happens, and this is true in Minnesota, and I would speculate it's true in most other places, but when someone comes into prison, stays for a short period of time, they typically get housed with other individuals who are staying for short periods of time and not participating in any programming. And when we do that, rather than creating a therapeutic community, which is consistent with effective interventions, we're creating a criminogenic community where we're taking individuals and making them worse, making prison what's essentially graduate school for criminals.
Interesting. So should we ask for longer sentences so there's more time to work with these individuals who have so many deficits that make it so difficult for them when they get back out into this difficult world of work in America today?
I don't think the solution is longer sentences for everyone. In fact, I don't think it would entail longer sentences, but I think what one of the solutions would be increasing the length of stay for those who do come into prison so that they can at least participate in programming that's been effective in reducing recidivism. But what that also means is that for those individuals, if our goal is to reduce warehousing and producing better outcomes, then that also means reducing the amount of time that individuals stay in prison for those who have really long sentences. So someone who has a sentence where they're going to be in prison for 20 or 25 years, the evidence suggests that those individuals are spending the vast majority of their time in prison being warehoused. And warehousing is costly, so what that would suggest is that rather than having that person stay in prison for 20 years, maybe it's 15 years instead of 20. Or someone who has a sentence of 10 years, rather than spending that whole time in prison, maybe it's 6 years or 7 years, so long as they participate in programming that has been proven to be effective.
Are the work release programs as controversial around the nation as they have been here in our state of Connecticut? Every time there is malfeasance on the part of one of the individuals let out, the whole program is lathered with what it is that individual did, and lots of people calling to pull it back.
That is always going to be one of the areas of concern with a program in which individuals are released from prison into the community, a program like work release. And one of the things that Minnesota does, and I imagine other states probably do as well, is that for those individuals who do get placed in what are referred to as early release programs, they tend to be lower risk individuals. And because individuals are eligible for the program based on their risk, that entails using risk assessment tools to determine who is a greater risk to the community and who's a lower risk. And in order for someone to get released early, they have to demonstrate that they are a lower risk. And that also means participating in programming while they're in prison to help reduce or mitigate that risk.
Grant Dewey is with us from the American Enterprise Institute and the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And I've got to ask you, Grant, this is a really interesting time for us to be talking because we see where the House passed a bipartisan prison reform bill, the First Step Act. And lots of places around the country, states have been talking about prison reform, Democrats, Republicans getting behind it. So is this a good first step?
I think the proposed legislation is actually, yes, a good first step. I don't think it's the panacea that some proponents of it might make it out to be, but I think the question recently is whether the First Step Act should become a law or whether we need to hold out for sentencing reform. And I think what I would suggest is that at a minimum we should implement the First Step Act, just because I do think it would bring about positive changes to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And that is one piece that is important for folks to understand, that this would just affect the federal prison system. And with the 1.5 million inmates in U.S. prisons, about 12-13% are federal prisoners, while the other 87-88% are state prisoners. This particular act would affect a relatively small portion of the nation's prisoners, but it would be a step in the right direction.
And who are the federal prisoners versus the state prisoners, just to give us all an insight into this?
The biggest distinction between state prisoners and federal prisoners probably has to do with drug offenses. About 20%, or it's probably a little less than 20%, I think it's about 18% of state-level prisoners are in for drug offenses, whereas more than half of the federal prison system, that population are drug offenders. And so that's probably the biggest difference that we see between the two.
When we look at drugs and we look at mental health issues, where I believe about 37% of the prison population suffers from various types of mental illnesses, how difficult does that make the job training and post-employment issue?
It can make it very challenging, especially if those mental disorders interfere with one's ability to either get an educational degree or a certification, as well as hold down employment. And so what we commonly see is that for those individuals who do have severe mental illnesses, that disability is frequently an option. But that also speaks to the fact that when individuals come into prison, that they usually have a number of factors that make it difficult for them to embrace a law-abiding lifestyle, and that they have multiple risk factors that when someone comes into prison, it's not usually because they lack a secondary degree, but instead it's they lack a secondary degree, they have no legitimate work history, they have a history of mental illness, maybe have a lengthy history of substance abuse, trying to self-medicate. And so, you know, usually we see a whole host of risk factors for those who do come into the prison systems.
I find that it's very interesting. You have some other factors that affect how well they're going to do on the outside after leaving prison. Prison visitation and cognitive behavioral therapy. Why do those have such an impact?
They both address what are known as major criminogenic needs or risk factors. And so with cognitive behavioral therapy, it really tries to address the criminal thinking that a lot of individuals who come into prison have, kind of these criminal thinking patterns, and cognitive behavioral therapy helps address that. Visitation, on the other hand, you know, taps more into providing individuals with pro-social support, because we see that having antisocial peers is a major risk factor for those who are in prison. And one of the things that we see, for example, is that for those individuals who are still in a gang lifestyle and still maintaining antisocial contacts, that they're more likely to reoffend after they get released from prison. However, with visitation, It provides individuals with pro-social supports. And that's also one of the reasons why a program that I mentioned earlier, Circles of Support and Accountability, works so well for high-risk sex offenders, is that it provides these individuals with pro-social support that they otherwise wouldn't have.
It's interesting. We did a couple of podcasts about the boys' crisis in America. And when you look at it, in many ways, prisons are homes for fatherless boys. And that creates all kinds of problems, because they often have a history of trauma and abuse that goes all the way through their lives.
That's absolutely true. We absolutely see that, yeah.
Now, when we look at some of the ideas that you folks have at the American Enterprise Institute in terms of your report on dealing the effectiveness of education and employment programming for prisoners, I would imagine, Grant, that there are a number of things you might suggest that are going to be controversial for those who say, we give these prisoners too much, and why should we do anything more for them? For example, you say, based on existing evidence, policymakers could consider reinstituting the Pell Grant eligibility for prisoners. Now, there are a lot of people listening who are trying to put their kids through college, and they're saying,
yep,
wait a minute, I'm having a difficult time. How do you respond to that?
And that is clearly a valid concern. But at the same time, I think it's worth pointing out that even if we don't spend any money to help provide education programming for someone who's in prison, that when they get released, we could end up spending more down the road, especially if they continue to commit new criminal offenses. And what the evidence indicates is that when there is increased access to education and employment programming while someone is in prison as well as after they get released, that it can reduce our societal costs over the long run. And the truth is that we spend a lot each year on prison. It's been estimated that we spend about $40 billion each year. And so if we can reduce that spending even a little bit, if that means providing education programming to individuals who are in prison, then I would suggest that we would get a much better return on that investment.
Do you think many people have that long view?
No, I don't. It's certainly a tough sell to make. I understand that. But if we're just looking at outcome, if we want our prison system to be more effective than it is, because a lot of the recent discussion that we've had is that our prison system is broken. And we see high recidivism rates, we see high use of things like solitary confinement, and so there's a consensus that we do need to repair the prison systems within this country. That's one of the reasons why I suspect there's bipartisan consensus for prison reform, is because of this perception that our prison systems are broken. However, one way in order to repair that brokenness is to provide individuals with the tools and the skills that they need so that they don't go back.
Now, you also say we should explore employer incentives for hiring individuals with criminal records, such as tax credits or fidelity bonds. I don't think I've heard much about those.
When employers hire someone who has a felony record or who has been in prison, then that makes it less costly for them in the event that there is some potential litigation down the road. And so that just makes it a little easier for employers to hire individuals who have been released from prison.
What about the notion of blocking the box so someone does not have to indicate that they've spent some time in prison, though they do have to account for that period on their resume where they weren't working?
Right. Banning the box is a relatively recent concept that has been instituted in some places. The evidence at this point is a little mixed as to whether that's an effective strategy. I think the jury is still out at this point.
Finally, are we misusing our prisons in America? I mean, we are told that our use of them is so excessive and that other societies really have figured out much better ways to get better results and to have more people back in the mainstream. What's your take on this?
I think that it's clear that when we look at the evidence and we see that the imprisonment rates in the U.S. is so much higher than what we see in other comparable countries, and the return on the investment that we have made in our prison system has not been very good. And I think part of that, however, is the fact that we continue to insist that prisons are supposed to be punitive, miserable places that are bereft of any shred of hope or dignity or any programming or interventions that can provide individuals with a way to turn their lives around. And I think that changing the way that we think about prisons and thinking about them and as places where individuals could potentially go and then get the skills and the tools that they need to become law-abiding citizens, and knowing that in doing so, it will create a situation where we can get a better return on the investment that we make in prisons.
Well, perhaps the First Step Act is a first step in that regard. And you may want to read this report, The Effectiveness of Education and Employment Programming for Prisoners, from the American Enterprise Institute. Grant Dewey, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trend.
Thank you.